Welcome to the fifth introductory lecture on the 19 letters. And at this point, we're going to examine some of the things that Rav Hirsch has done and some of his effects that he still has on Jewish life today. So Rav Hirsch, we know, based on his diary entries, that he had an extreme sense of purpose. And we'll discuss this more a little later when we discuss him biographically. Now, Rav Hirsch, he was a prolific writer and speaker. Rav Hirsch delved into Tamei HaMitzvos, and his book Chorev is all about the understanding of the mitzvot. First he gives you psukim, and then he gives you his understanding of the mitzvah, which is followed by practical details of the mitzvah. He explains that Torah is considered a divine anthropology. I believe I saw this in Diane Grunfeld's introduction, which basically means, divine anthropology, that the Torah is an account of man from the perspective of the divine, meaning God's perspective on what man is. Right? There is not so much in the Torah about God himself, but there's a lot in the Torah. The main point of the Torah is to understand the account of man from the divine perspective. And therefore, mitzvos are educational tools for the formation of the ideal human being, which we are supposed to sanctify Hashem's name through every one of our actions. Rav Hirsch writes about this by an essay he has on Tammuz, which I will read out. It's not terribly long. But basically what he says, just to summarize it first, is that the luchos were read the same way, no matter how you looked at it. So he says, so too a Jew, no matter what circumstance he's in, he must bear the stamp of being a Jew as it's shaped by the Torah. So again, this comes from Tammuz, and it's on page 281 on the Collective Writings, and I believe that's in volume 1. So he starts by quoting the psukim here. And he gave to Moshe, when he had made an end of speaking with him on Har Sinai, the two tables of the testimony. The tables were to be proof that he had spoken with him on Har Sinai, and at the same time to show how his word was to be understood and carried out by us. The tables were of stone, but they were written with the finger of God. This means that we must allow the earthly material to be stirred and shaped by the finger of God. We must willingly submit the earthly stuff to receive the stamp of the divine spirit and the divine will, and to be shaped into a bearer of the divine word. We must not let the spirit remain merely spirit, and the word merely word, but we must bring them into the range of our whole earthly life as dominant and formative forces, in order that our whole earthly material may receive its stamp and its value and its shape from the finger of God, and our earthly existence may be nothing but a monument and a document given by God and testified to God. This is the sum and substance of the utterance set forth from Sinai. And the tables were written on both their sides, mizeh umizeh, on the one side and on the other they were written. The word from Sinai must not grip us only superficially and one-sidedly. It must penetrate us through and through. It must set its stamp indelibly on every part of our being, and whichever way we are turned, the writing of God must everywhere be visible on us, clearly and legibly. See the divine tables of testimony. On them there was no above and below, no front and back. The writing pierced right through them, and yet they could be read on both sides. This must be a model for you. Be a Jew through and through. Whichever way you are turned, be a Jew. Do not engrave the divine writing only on one side, one part, one aspect of your being, so that you will appear a Jew and a missioner of the divine name, and the divine will only, when regarded from one side, and one aspect, but when you turn your back and enter into other relationships, you will appear as anything but a Jew, a missioner for anything but the name and the will of God. Or at any rate, you will not be so completely a Jew, you will not be so clearly stamped as a missioner of God's will. Be a Jew through and through on all sides and in all aspects, and do not esteem one side as facing more directly towards the Godhead. Do not imagine that you have received the stamp of the divine word with more emphasis on this one side, and that you could allow the other side to be content with the after effects of this stamp and with the mere traces of this imprint. Do not think that people, as they look on one side, can discern that the force of the divine word has penetrated to the other. When you speak of what you call the main sides and the main periods and the main items and the main articles of your Judaism, in relation to God, there is no reverse side and no opposite side. Everything is turned to God and must be taken equally seriously, and every side the stamp of the divine will is to be placed with the same force and care and directness. Let yourself be penetrated through and through from all sides with the divine word. Okay, so that's a very eloquent way of showing that we have to be through and through completely sanctifying Hashem's name, and the mode that that happens is through mitzvos, through a life of Torah. Now, Rav Hirsch was very into communal aspects, and the kehilos at that point were basically, in a lot of places, non-existent due to reform and secularism, etc. These things really fell apart. Rav Hirsch basically reinstituted, I mean, I'm not sure to what effect, more than other Rabbanim in Germany, but certainly he reinstituted the idea of the kehila. Rav Hirsch had a novel approach to understanding the Torah, which we know he wrote his famous Parish on the Torah, which is probably his best-known work. And his interpretation, really, like a few other writers as well, of Rabbanim, includes both the oral and the written Torah. And that was one of Hirsch's main goals when writing this, was to show that there's no separation between the two, but rather that, and we'll discuss this in way more detail later on, the written Torah is basically notes as a person would take in a class that reflect the entire shir only if you were at the shir, meaning the Torah Sheba'al Peh is considered the shir, and the written Torah is like the notes on it. So this is his approach that he takes, like similarly to the Malbim, who also connects these together, the oral and the written. Rav Hirsch used Tanakh, and he has Pirushim on various parts of Nach. So we already discussed the use of Kant to meaning certainly if you want to say that Rav Hirsch didn't use Kant per se, he certainly used the modern scientific method with his interpretation of the Torah, which is a different way of looking at Torah. He used ideas of humanism, as we discussed briefly. And in a lot of ways, we could say that Rav Hirsch is really the architect of current Judaism. Now, you could replace the word current with modern, if you'd like, modern Judaism. But I just want to be clear what's meant by the word modern. And there are two meanings, I think, that we could probably give to modern. According to Rav Hirsch, it means that I'm an absolute full Jew, and I never give in even one iota if it has any part that's not fully Jewish. Yet at the same time, anything that the Torah permits is allowed, and it could and it should be used, because the Torah is meant to be used here and now in this world. However, the typical definition of modern Judaism, and this is probably the way the word modern is usually used, is described by Diane Grunfeld, which actually is a quote that he took from the same article we had from Samson A. Hirsch. He writes, "Whatever form it may assume," that's again modern Judaism, "it always shows the same primary motors, impatience of any authority from within, attachment to everything from without. Thus modern, which we are all very familiar with, is cutting corners in halacha, not having learning as a primary objective in life, etc." The Hirschian Jew, so to say, would never cut any corners in any type of halacha, and Torah is always primary. So anyway, just to summarize these two definitions, there's the idea of being modern as in current in the world, but always being that 100% full Jew and never giving in on anything that is less than fully Jewish. And number two would be making everything b'di'eved, that now it's a lechachila to you. So depending on the idea of modern, over here we certainly mean the first method in the first way. Now Rav Hirsch began what would be the forerunner of the Aguda movement. And in Germany, this organization was called the Free Union for the Interests of Orthodox Judaism. So in other words, without Rav Hirsch, I'm not sure that Aguda would have existed. And if it did, it probably would have been different. Because all these organizations, when they first started, and others, as we're going to talk about soon, had real German influence in them. And Rav Hirsch was definitely considered as being one of the forerunners of the Aguda movement.
In my searches online, I found the following statement. It said, "In the early 20th century, Agudas Yisrael, the Israelite Union, was established as the political arm of traditional orthodoxy, representing a wide range of anti-modern branches who were not yet ready to accept the cultural openness of Hirsch's neo-orthodoxy." Now, when I first saw this statement, my first reaction was, well, I mean, it's pretty obvious that Rav Hirsch's influence and his students were really who began and started the Aguda movement and the Beis Yaakov movement. So, for example, Rabbi Isaac Breuer, Rav Yaakov Rosenheim, actually it's Moreno Yaakov Rosenheim, and Rabbi Dr. Shmuel Deutschlander. I looked around online to see where I could find this statement, and I found it from a professor named Professor Eliezer Siegel. And he told me that he got his sources basically from two places. One is a biography on Rav Hirsch called Tradition in the Age of Reform, The Religious Philosophy of Samson Raphael Hirsch. This is by Noah Rosenblum. I have to say that this is a biography that I have not read yet.
And for various reasons, I don't plan on it. If anyone wants to know why, you could email me. And the second source that he told me was from the Encyclopedia Judaica, which I don't believe I looked that up either. But either way, he told me that his point in this statement was just to say that whatever influence that Rav Hirsch had on the creation of the Aguda was really limited to administrative details, and we know that the German community, the German people in general, were very good with those things, especially in the Beis Yaakov movement, that really comes to the fore, that they really, like Rabbi Deutschlander, for example, he was really able to pull together the Beis Yaakov movement. And his point was is that really any Hirschian influence was really outnumbered by Hasidic and Haredi representatives. Now, I don't know if that's correct or not correct, but certainly we'll quote some sources to show there was definitely an influence on the creation of Aguda, although I personally do not know to what extent. I'll just quote for you from Rabbi Yom Shlomo Hamiger of B'nai Brak. He said the following. He said, Agudas Yisrael, by the way, was founded in neither Poland nor in Lithuania, and not even in Katowice. It was founded in Germany by Moreinu Yaakov Rosenheim, Zecher Livracha, and his colleagues. Agudas Yisrael actually developed from the Union of Orthodox Jewish Communities in Germany, an organization that was founded by Rav Hirsch. Rav Rosenheim was its chairman, and he sent Rabbi Dr. Shmuel Deutschlander to assist Sarah Schneer. Dr. Deutschlander provided the impetus for the formation of Beis Yaakov by inviting Orthodox teachers from Germany to come and to lend a hand in setting up the movement. So I just want to read some more about this. This comes from the Rav Hirsch biography by Art Skrull, and the author is Rabbi Klugman, and this is on page 190. It says, Rabbi Hirsch was the principal Jewish thinker and leader, illuminating a path for Torah Jews in a rapidly changing new world. And his last major undertaking was the creation of an organization dedicated to strengthening Jewish life from within and to serving as German Orthodoxy's representative to the outside world. Today, the concept of Orthodox Jewish organization is so entrenched that one may assume that it was ever thus. Yet such organization was largely non-existent 100 years ago. Rabbi Hirsch's last contribution to his people's national heritage was to be the free union for the interest of Orthodox Jewry, the forerunner of the Agudas Yisrael movement. Rabbi Hirsch founded the Orthodox Union in September 1885. Its goal was to strengthen Orthodox Judaism in Germany. To that end, it took upon itself the task of preserving existing institutions and providing the means necessary to support all aspects of Jewish life. Its objective vis-a-vis the outside world was to combat the Reform movement and to represent the interests of Orthodox Jewry before the government. In the course of time, these political activities came to occupy an important portion of the Orthodox Union's agenda, and it became recognized as the voice of German Orthodoxy, both by German Jewry and in the eyes of the government. Rabbi Hirsch stood at the head of the Orthodox Union until his death, whereupon it was taken over by his son, Dr. Naftali Hirsch, and then later on in 1905 by Rabbi Yaakov Rosenheim. The Orthodox Union undertook various projects, including finding jobs, providing unemployment compensation for Shabbos observers, setting up kosher eating establishments, etc., etc., and lists a whole bunch of other things that they did. The Orthodox Union was active until the Nazi rise to power, and during that time, it played a role that far exceeded the sum total of its activities. The Agudas Yisrael movement was a direct outgrowth of the Orthodox Union. The latter organization provided the model for an international organization of Torah Jews, as well as many of the core organizers and activists who built the Aguda. It was at the 1908 convention of the Orthodox Union in Frankfurt that the international organization was first proposed, and the Orthodox Union even paid for the initial expenses of the as-yet-nascent Agudas Yisrael. Okay, so I think it's pretty clear that Rav Hirsch was definitely the forerunner of the Aguda movement. So now, a very interesting point is mentioned by Mark Shapiro, again in his book, Between the Yeshiva World and Modern Orthodoxy, on pages 43 and 44. So basically he says that if the Eastern European Rabbanim understood Rav Hirsch and German Orthodoxy, it's unlikely that they ever would have agreed to join the German-led Aguda movement. And he writes conversely that if the German rabbis and communal leaders realized that in half a century the Aguda would fall under the control of the East European elements and become the ideological opponents of Rav Hirsch's vision of Torah and Derech Eretz, it is unlikely that they would have founded such an organization. Okay, so back to our topics here of things that Rav Hirsch has done. Secular studies in general, education was extremely important, as we discussed. And furthermore, as we discussed Torah Derech Eretz, how Torah is the lens through which the entire world is examined. Another thing that Rav Hirsch was really a forerunner of in education, and Rav Hirsch was a master mechanich, in the education of boys and the education of girls. He was the forerunner of the yeshiva educational system as we have it today, I guess as we would call it the modern yeshiva movement, the Mudei Kodesh with secular. Not that he was the first one to do it, but he's certainly the first one to popularize that. And he felt that the education of both boys and girls was of paramount importance. And you can clearly see today in the more yeshivish schools how people are uncomfortable with the system, and sometimes they might degrade it. Like, for example, sending to high schools where there's very minimal secular studies and not appreciating any secular studies that's done, to really, you know, look down upon it or to sneer at it. Rav Hirsch had what we could say clearly was the forerunner of the Beis Yaakov movement, as we already mentioned. And Sarah Schneer, she planned to train girls in the Torah Derech Eretz system, but since she knew that the yeshiva system would never accept such a thing as Torah Derech Eretz, so she basically said that her logic was that women are the ones that are going to raise the next generation, but at the same time, she educated her students to marry the typical yeshiva man at the time. And she saved Polish Jewry. It's probably no question about it, really. And if she really did intend that the system should have strong Torah Derech Eretz components, and she, by the way, did use Chorev and Rav Hirsch's writings in her teacher's seminary, so obviously that changed over time. And the Beis Yaakov movement of today is really more of, we would say, in a lot of ways, is of the yeshiva movement more than of Rav Hirsch. But certainly Rav Hirsch was the forerunner of this. So I just want to read from an interview that was done with Rav Hamiger of B'nai Brak on the Beis Yaakov movement, just to give some idea of how German Orthodoxy, which was rebuilt by Rav Hirsch, had such a powerful influence beyond Germany. And Rabbi Hamiger basically states that Rav Hirsch managed to reconstruct Orthodoxy throughout all of Europe. And he goes on in this interview to explain that Sarah Schneer, when she was in Vienna, she attended shul called the Stempfergasse, or Gasse, I'm not exactly sure how to say it. And she heard a Rav speaking. This was Rav Dr. Moshe Flesch. And he was discussing the Maccabim and Yehudis, because it was Hanukkah time. And she went over to the Rav afterwards, to this Rav Flesch, and asked him where he got his ideas from and how she could learn more. And basically he said that he learned in the Frankfurt Yeshiva and that these ideas belong to Rav Hirsch. So not only did she study Rav Hirsch, but she also studied the writings of Rav Dr. Marcus Lehman. And she began to gather girls and teach them Torah through these systems of understanding. And eventually, I mean, you could certainly look up how this happened, is developed into the Beis Yaakov movement. Just another interesting quote he has here. He says, in her seminary in Krakow, Sarah Schneer taught Rav Hirsch's writings in German. The teacher spoke German, and the Polish students learned German. So that's Rav Hirsch as the forerunner to Beis Yaakov. So just to read a little more of Rav Hirsch's influence on all of Europe, we'll look now in the Hirsch biography. This is in chapter 6, on page 66. And Rabbi Klugman writes, although Rabbi Salanter, that's Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, did not realize his plan to publish 19 letters in Russia, the work ultimately revolutionized Torah education in Eastern Europe in another way. On Shabbos Chanukah of 1915, a young Polish refugee in Vienna went to the Stempfergasse Synagogue. There she heard a drasha from Rabbi Moshe David Flesch, student of Rabbi Hirsch's son-in-law and his successor, Rabbi Salomon Breuer. Rabbi Flesch often quoted Rav Hirsch, and that Shabbos was no exception. The young refugee was electrified by Rabbi Flesch's words, and through him she was introduced to the 19 letters and to Chorev. The young woman was Sarah Schneer, and she often said in her later years that it was these two works that inspired her to found the Beis Yaakov movement. And he has in the footnote here, he says that from the moment she was first exposed to it, she felt an obligation to pass Rav Hirsch's legacy on to the young girls of her native country. In the first Beis Yaakov seminary in Krakow, hundreds of mimeographed copies of selections from Rav Hirsch's works were passed from hand to hand, and no other books in the school library were so sought after as were his commentaries on the Torah, Tehillim, the Siddur, and his collective writings. From the first class she taught in the Krakow Seminary till the last month of her life, Sarah Schneer continued to teach the 19 letters. Her co-workers in the founding of the Beis Yaakov movement insist that the movement would have been unthinkable without Rabbi Hirsch's writings, especially his commentary on the Torah, which was the basis of the lessons on the subject taught by Sarah Schneer and her staff.
So that's very good in terms of understanding Rav Hirsch's influence later on the Beis Yaakov movement. But how about in Germany itself, in terms of education for girls? So this comes from the same biography, the Art Scroll biography. This is on page 223. And I know there's a lot to read, but I think this is well worth it, because this really gives you a picture of how far his influence went. Rabbi Hirsch was a trailblazer in his conception of girls' education. One of his most significant and perhaps least recognized innovations, ideas that he originated, are now universally accepted as fundamental principles of education. The girls in the Real Shul study the same subjects, including Chumash and Hebrew grammar, as the boys, except for Talmud and mathematics, in place of which they were taught handicrafts. Many years before the Real Shul opened its doors, Rabbi Hirsch had argued in Chorev that Jewish girls must be given a meticulous grounding in the basics of Torah and Jewish thought. We'll actually see later on that Rabbi Hirsch dedicated Chorev to the young thinking men and women of Israel, which was a revolutionary thing to write on the front of a book by a Gadol Hador. Anyway, as Rabbi Hirsch explains his program, people forget that Chana and Devorah most certainly understand Chana's prayer and Devorah's song. They also forget that the rescue of future generations of our men, as well as our women, depends on our success in winning the devotion of our future wives and mothers' hearts to the sanctity of our people. The only way we could hope to sway their hearts is by teaching them to draw spiritual nourishment from the original sources, to prefer on their own Yeshayahu and Amos to Goethe and Shakespeare. And this, with God's help, we have been able to do. If you wish to provide for your future, do not forget your daughters. Thus, in addition to the decisive influence Rabbi Hirsch's writings had on the establishment of the Beis Yaakov movement, organized institutional instruction of young girls actually originated in Frankfurt. The results of the Hirschian approach to women's education were dramatic. The Orthodox women of Frankfurt and its satellite communities were renowned for their learning as well as for their deep piety. As a general rule, the observant women of Germany were more learned than their Eastern European counterparts due to the broad Jewish education they received. On a note on the bottom, he says, when Sarah Schneer sought an assistant to develop the girls' seminary she opened in Krakow, she had to look as far as Frankfurt to find someone, and she took Judith Rosenbaum, who became known as Rebbetzin Grunfeld, Diane Grunfeld's wife. Anyway, on Shabbos and the festivals, the women's section of the Big Shul, its official name was the Beis Tefilas Yeshurun, in Frankfurt was filled to capacity with women of all ages, from young girls to grandmothers, the result of the thorough Jewish education they had received in the Real Shul. Okay, so a couple more ideas, more things that Rav Hirsch has influenced would be the idea of equality between men and women in terms of their lot given to them by God. Rav Hirsch discusses equal rights before any such ideas necessarily existed, certainly not in a writing form or something that was being necessarily spoken about. He discusses how Judaism really pushes that in terms of just what it is. And he basically shaped a lot of the modern Jewish world. He discusses the idea of not being afraid to ask questions based on science and how that's part of the Torah Derech Eretz system. And he's basically given the non-yeshivish yeshiva student, or non-yeshiva student, a full world view outlook. The German word is Weltanschauung. So he gave them this hashkafa to be proud of. And I'd like to, without reading out the entire article here, just to turn your attention to an article by Rav Yitzhak Adlerstein. And the title is Proud to be a Hirschian. And you could find it on, again, the Cross Currents website, and type in Proud to be a Hirschian, and the article should come up. It's not a very long article, but it discusses some of these ideas. And maybe I'll just read out a little bit of it. He writes here, about halfway through the article, he writes, in 3 decades of trying to explain Torah Judaism to brighter, frum students, to non-frum skeptics, and to non-Jews, the works of no other thinker has been as valuable as those of Rav Hirsch in explaining the overall telos of Torah life. Telos is like the goal or the purpose. Without Ramchal and Maharal, Rav Adlerstein is an expert on Maharal, I could not explain the Torah universe. Without Rav Hirsch, I cannot convey the individual. Only in the works of Rav Hirsch are major themes of modernity, free will versus scientific materialism, nationalism, universalism, sensuality, the aesthetic, totalitarianism, not only discussed, but shown to be focal points of the Torah's instruction. So he continues to explain how the Chumash has such an impact. He pulls it together really, really beautifully.
and the understanding that the world as a whole is a beautiful place, a way to connect to Hashem, and that Yesh Chachma Bagoyim. And he, at the end, he quotes Rav Schwab, definitely a worthwhile article to look up, and he ends it off by saying, "Now as never before, I am proud to be a Hirshian." Now, I think as a summary and a review of everything that we've said until now, and it's actually an excellent review, I refer the listener to the book Three Generations by Diane Grunfeld, which we mentioned earlier, pages 8 through 12. The paragraph on 8 starts, "In order to appreciate the historical position," and on 12 it ends, "Opponents could not help expressing their admiration." Now, I'm not going to read it all because it's too many pages to read, but if anyone has access to that book, that would be an excellent summary of everything we've said until now.